This episode of the Nitty Gritty Committee is not for the faint of heart, and you might not want to tackle it in public because it's deeply emotional stuff, and I'm not kidding around. It features 29-year-old newlywed Megan Osborne, who is alive today because of the liver and the kidney that were donated to her by strangers. And sitting beside her are Michelle and John Seckel, who made the most selfless and generous decision I have literally ever heard of in my life. They donated the organs of their 3-year-old son, Ethan. He was a rambunctious little boy who loved waving at the trains that passed by his back fence until one day he climbed the fence and got too close. This is his mother, Michelle.
I'd literally just walked, like I'd seen the kids in the backyard, and I looked out the window, and then I walked over to the dishwasher and I pulled out the top rack of the dishwasher, and I'd just finished putting away the glasses in the top rack of the dishwasher when the train horn went, which isn't anything unusual. It just gave a second really long blast, and I don't know why, but my stomach just sank, and then all I heard was screaming.
Yeah, from the other kids. How many other kids do you have?
Ethan was our number 3 or 4, and I was watching 2 extras that day as well.
Oh, so, wow.
I think I knew it was serious as soon as I heard that, like that. There was just something about that second blast on the train horn. And then you can usually tell when your kids give a scream, whether it's sort of a, you know, okay, they've done something and I need to get there, or whether, oh, hang on a minute, that might be. And it was a very serious crap.
From the other kids.
I initially thought he was dead. Yeah, when I got to him, that was all, like, I can just remember just saying, he's dead, he's dead, he's dead.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And it wasn't until the granddad of the other kids that were there, he was still there. We were actually having a coffee. And I remember him on the phone saying to the 000 operator, she's saying that the little fella's passed away. Gosh. And when I heard that, I went, I haven't even checked. And I checked and he had a pulse, but he wasn't actually breathing. So I then got him breathing again and said to, you know, said, no, he's not dead. He's actually still alive. But yeah, so it was bad from the get-go.
Every now and then I think, I don't know, for some reason, probably not for some reason, because I knew I was going to be talking to you guys. I was lying in bed last night by myself and the house was quiet and I was thinking about the kids and I thought, God, you're so vulnerable. I can understand why some people don't ever want to have children, because anything can happen at any time to anyone. But when you have children, it just, you have that vulnerability all the time. And that's what happened to you guys. So how were you generous enough to offer your baby's organs to other people when you'd lost him?
Well, Michelle and I were standing in ICU, and it was the accident was on a Monday. And it had been detailed to us that Ethan's injuries were of such that it was going to be unrecoverable and we weren't going to be able to take him home. And it was late Monday afternoon, holding his hands in ICU, and Michelle and I both looked at each other and we started a conversation and said what we wouldn't give to have the doctors come in here and give Ethan a new head and you can take him home. You know, it sounds absurd, but that the topic of conversation. And, you know, Ethan, you think 3-year-old train, you think of horrendous injuries. Ethan was injured in no other way than a bump on the head. He wasn't run over. So there was still a perfect little 3-year-old boy there to hold hands and cuddle and kiss, and apart from the obvious head injury. And I then said to Michelle, what do you mean? And she said, well, somewhere in the hospital, you know, there's other families doing the same. And, you know, as a parent and particularly a dad, you want to protect your children. And we were bargaining with every worldly possession we had just to have our little boy survive. And it was devastating. It was gut-wrenching. And Michelle said, you know, we can't get our miracle, but through Ethan, we can give other families their miracle, that they were in a room or somewhere bargaining with every worldly possession they had to get that transplant so they could keep their loved one alive. Or and so we approached the doctor and said we'd like to know if Ethan could be a organ and tissue donor, and that obviously set all the wheels in motion. And Ethan, at that particular time, hadn't been declared brain dead. He still had some signs of brain activity, and it was detailed to us that due to a legislation change in Victoria at the time, there was a second pathway available for donation, which was donation after cardiac death, which basically means that we turn the life support off and there's a window of 90 minutes. And if Ethan passed away within that 90 minutes, he could still be an organ and tissue donor. So we decided to do that. We thought, let's let Ethan decide. Ethan was the type of kid that shared everything he had. And if he was old enough to understand what he was doing, we have no doubt he would have agreed to it. And we turned the life support off, and he didn't even take a breath. He'd finally admitted defeat. And, you know, he'd fought so hard to try and stay alive. And, you know, watching your son take his last breath is, you know, something no parent should ever go through. But, you know, in the nearly 4 years since that, just the joy that we feel and the humbleness, and it's just so humbling to know that our little boy has touched three lives and continues to touch many lives through his story and his foundation and everything. And, you know, less than 1% of people pass away in the right circumstances to allow for donation, and that's a pretty exclusive club, and our little boy's a part of it. And, you know, that's very special. We didn't do it for recognition. We didn't do it for any other reason than we didn't want another family to lose a child, regardless of the age of that child. And, you know, as it turned out, Ethan's kidneys went to an adult male. So, you know, it's the medical teams do amazing things to allow this type of stuff to occur. And it's just a very special feeling to know that. And we would change it in a heartbeat. We can't. So we focus on what we can change, and that's hopefully getting people to have the conversation about organ and tissue donation. And, you know, one of the things we always say, you could ask two questions, one being, would you donate? And there'd be a percentage of people say yes, there'd be a percentage of people say no, and whatever the numbers are, it's irrelevant. But if you ask the other question of, would you accept it if it meant saving your life or the life of a loved one, I could almost guarantee 100% of people would say yes. And that was how we ultimately came to the decision that if that was Ethan laying there needing something to survive, we would have taken it. So it's awfully selfish to not be prepared to give it. And Ethan didn't pass away to donate his organs. Ethan was going to pass away. And we were fortunate enough that through Ethan we could give others the gift of life.
There's not many people who would ever, ever get to that point that you two got to, let alone within, you know, that time frame. It's incredible.
It just gave it some meaning. It doesn't make it easier. It just makes it a little bit better.
Yeah, but it also makes you very special people and your relationship. I mean, again, a lot of couples don't survive the loss of a child, but for the two of you to move forward this way, I mean, I'm making assumptions here. Is your relationship still strong?
It is.
Stronger than ever. I actually remarried Michelle about 18 months after the accident. It was our 10th wedding anniversary. I surprised her, and I thought, you know what, after everything we've gone through, you know, for better or for worse, you can't get much worse. And we made a commitment that it was going to be for better or worse, and our actual wedding, we got married under the willow trees down by the river on my parents' property, and I surprised Michelle, picked her up and blindfolded her and had our three surviving children with a photo of Ethan each and standing there, and, you know, basically recommitted to her and said, you know, even though we've lost Jim, you know, I still love you, still think the world of you, and I'm very proud of you. And, you know, she still amazes me. She's returned to school studying a double degree in nursing paramedicine to live her dream, and, you know, she's just an amazing, inspirational person. She's my rock.
Yeah, God. That's amazing. I should make it very clear that Ethan's organs, I don't know if you know who they went to. They did not go to you, Megan. You are an organ recipient.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about the organs that you received, where they came from?
a little bit about the second transplant only because they were still on life support when I got the call.
Wow.
So I was under a similar situation. They told me that I had a kidney that was a match, but again, it was up to the weight of how long till they passed away after they turned off the life support. So I had pretty much two days sitting on that transplant. Just didn't know whether I was going to go through with it. I was actually at the movies at the time, watching a movie, which we went back in and watched, but we didn't watch any of it.
No.
But that was a male, I think, in his 40s. And I just said to them, because I really want children, if the kidney is strong enough to get me through a pregnancy, because it wasn't a perfect match. So you actually have the option of whether to take it. And I said, if it'll get me through a pregnancy, I'd take it.
Wow.
So that one went through.
Now, this is really hard for me to say, but I'm sure it's not hard for any of you to hear because this is your life and such a big part of your lives.
Yeah.
But I've done a lot of reading about it in the last couple of days, and I've read people who are waiting for transplants saying they live through this awful phase of hearing about a car crash and thinking, I wonder if that could be my kidney.
Yeah, well, Mum actually just told me this story on the way up that there was an accident the night before my liver transplant, and she doesn't know what made her think about it, but it was on the news or something, and then the next day I got my call.
Yeah.
But she doesn't, obviously, there's
lots of accidents
that they might not have died in the right situation. Like you said, only 1% of people can go on to be transplants.
Yeah. But there must be a level of guilt with that. I think as humans, our survival instinct is incredibly powerful. I mean, you guys have shown it in the way that you have survived the death of your baby. And you've survived it to keep your relationship, keep your life going and keep your family together for the other kids and create a foundation in his honour. And you've shown it in that your organs were failing you and you have, and you're waiting to get somebody else's organs.
Yeah.
The survival instinct is so strong. Is there a guilt attached with that?
I feel the same as you guys in the fact that I'm an organ donor.
Okay.
Even though I've received organs, I've always believed in organ donation. My family's always believed in organ donation. My family's, I've got 50 aunties and uncles or something like that. We're associated with death all the time, unfortunately, because there's so many of us.
Yep.
So, you know, our family's aware of that, and I've only met one person who's not, that I've come across that's not for organ donation. But like you said, they would give it to their own children. So,
what are some of the reasons? I read one that I'd never thought of. One person said, "Oh, I reckon if you say you're an organ donor, won't fight as hard to save you." And I never ever thought of it that way before. But apparently, that's quite a common idea.
There's a lot of myths out there in regards to it, and you know, as a society, a lot of conspiracy theorists to use a term that make or form opinions on misinformation, and that can become dangerous, and that relates to everything, not just organ and tissue donation.
Yes, but you're right.
I'm sure Michelle will back me up here saying that the level of care that was afforded to us by Ambulance Victoria,
yeah,
and then the surgical teams and the trauma teams at the Royal Children's Hospital was second to none. They tried so gallantly to save our little boy and did everything within their training and everything that was humanly possible to save our little boy.
Of course, and it's all anonymous. So why on earth would they sacrifice one person for another when they don't know any of them?
Correct.
And on the recipient side, the doctors make it quite clear you might not get your transplant that you're waiting for. They tell you up front you might not get one. A lot of people die on the waiting list.
I read in the States that there was a 12-month period. You could be on the list for 12 months, and at the end of that 12 months you had to go through all the tests again, and if at that point they judged your general health to not be up to it, then they took you off the list.
They can do that in Australia.
Wow.
So if you're not fit enough to receive the transplant, they don't want to take a transplant and give it to someone who may not be able to carry that transplant through its life. Like, at the end of the day, we've got to respect the organ.
Of course.
That it's going to provide a quality of life and give that to someone. We don't, like, if there's no treatment for someone, there's no treatment.
So you're on two lists.
I received my liver in 2008 and my kidney in 2013.
So were you on the kidney list in 2008 as well? That was later.
Yeah, so I had a liver transplant from cryptogenic liver disease, similar to Wilson's disease. So
what is that?
My body didn't accept copper, which caused the breakdown of my liver.
Wow.
But they couldn't diagnose it as Wilson's disease because I didn't have the Kayser-Fisher rings. It's very technical.
Yeah, okay. But it's your life. You've grown up with this. How old were you when all of this diagnosis started?
21.
Okay. But so, as a child, were you sickly as a child?
I had chronic fatigue, but no association. In hindsight, which is a great thing, I had liver spots on my body, but I had eczema as a child. Then my eyes started to become yellow. Mum actually used to beg me to go to the doctors. She's a nurse. I didn't want to go to the doctors. I was an independent person. I was always had a fear of doctors from back when I was 13 and I went to the Royal Children's. They're allowed to take me home for the day. I locked myself in the bathroom, all those fun things. But then one day I went to Thailand actually, and people asked me if I was pregnant. And I was like, I'm not pregnant. But I had that much ascites. So I admitted myself went into emergency department, told them I thought I had Wilson's disease.
Oh.
They took a blood test, took me straight through. I was bawling my eyes out. But within a blood test, I was straight through. And it was
so
pretty bad.
Do you remember, what do you remember of them telling you about needing a transplant on that day? Did they give you the numbers straight away of how many people are on the list in front of you and stuff like that?
For the liver, I went to Geelong Hospital. Then they don't do transplants. Mm-hmm. So I went to the Austin Hospital, and there I've got a transplant team there. So I saw them. I was on the waiting list. I went on April 1st, April Fool's Day. And then I got my transplant the second week in September that year. But
okay, that's
pretty fast.
Yeah, why is that?
I actually went to the doctors on a Friday and they said, you need to be our next transplant.
Okay.
But I was actually still working full time at the time. I didn't feel sick.
Yeah.
I guess my body was doing other things. Like, I've never felt like a sick person, but my body has other stories. The bloods and everything was showing a totally different story.
So liver and kidney transplants, I mean, I know that bodies can reject organs, right?
Yeah.
Is that still, what are the statistics around that? Do you know how often?
I had a mild case of rejection with my liver, but I think some PRED and some more immunosuppressants.
You got to keep it.
I got to keep it. That was only, and again with the kidney, very early on, but I haven't had any signs of rejection since.
Did you guys ever worry about that it was all, would it be for nothing? Do you even know what happens after you donate the organs?
Well, as I said earlier, we know that both his kidneys went to an adult male and two children received his heart valves.
Wow.
And we've heard from the man that received his kidneys, we got a letter.
Yeah.
And he was pretty ill. He was on dialysis for 5 to 6 days a week for 5 to 6 hours at a time. So he's got his life back. But because it is anonymous, it's probably, we think, we can only speak personally, that it is a good thing, and it is what it is. And we have to, as we've moved on from the accident, you have to accept that everything happens for a reason, whatever that reason is. And if the transplant was successful, it was successful. If it wasn't, it wasn't. So you can't sort of focus on the what ifs.
Yes. Like I say, I can personally tell you it's a good thing.
Yeah. Of course.
Especially dialysis is hell.
Yeah.
Is one word to describe
dialysis. Is removing your blood and cleaning it through a machine and
so
putting it back in, right?
I actually have a fistula.
Wow. So you've got a lump on your wrist the size of almost an egg size. Wow.
It is quite big. So I actually, you can feel it. It vibrates.
Why does it vibrate?
It's a vein and an artery joined together. So that actually is where I needled myself. You can see the scars where I needled myself at home because I worked full time. Being young, I wanted to have a house and all those kind of things. I don't think I would do it from home again. Just it was a lot. It's a lot of fatigue. You do it overnight. The machine runs 8 hours.
So you know exactly what Ethan saved this
days,
man from.
Yeah. Dialysis, mum couldn't be in there. Sometimes the machine would clot. And then you'd have to start the new lines. I can show you photos of the dialysis machine. It beeps constantly. If there's an air bubble, it just has a humming sound all night. It's like, I would imagine, having a baby. You know how you stay awake?
Mm-hmm.
You've got that sense of awareness always. You have to be aware. Even though you're sleeping, the machine that, the minute that machine beeps, you've got to be on because that's got your life.
Because you're a young woman, so you want to keep living your life.
Yeah.
So you're doing your dialysis at night so it doesn't interrupt your life.
So I can work, so I can have a house, so I can be normal as possible.
But your life hasn't been normal.
No.
I was just struck when John said, you know, this, everything happens for a reason. And I thought, do you think that
quality of life is 100 times better?
Do you think you understand the quality of your life better now that you had it
so low? Sometimes I watch Friends and I'm like, is this for real? Do you know what I mean? Is people really whinging about this stuff? So in that grasp, I understand the luxuries of life, like drinking water, eating salt food, like a packet of salt and vinegar chips.
Wow.
Because salt creates absorption in your body. So no salt, less water, no fluid retention, no pressure on your heart, all those kind of things. So,
and being able to sleep at night.
Being able to sleep without a machine is amazing. My friends ask me about when having a baby, you'll be so sleep deprived. I'm like, I think I've already done that. I've done that. I'm pretty sure the baby's not awake 8 hours a night.
No,
we'll see.
And you should have at least one other person there to help you with that. Whereas with your dialysis, that had to be you.
Yeah,
every night.
I'm the only one trained in needling, and so there's only so much that one person can do.
How do other people relate to you? Now, I'm sure you've noticed, and I feel really guilty about it. Every time I talk to you guys, I cry. And I just, I feel really embarrassed, and I feel like you deserve better, honestly. But, you know, like, how do other people relate to you, John and Michelle, since this happened, since you lost a child, since they found out what you did after that?
It's been something that it has been sort of hard to deal with because people do cry, which is completely understandable because, you know, it's not something that people want to think about.
No.
Dying is not something that we deal with well as a society anyway.
Yeah.
Without the fact that it was a three-year-old child that died. People don't deal with that very well, and there's been people that either just pretend it hasn't happened at all. And I've had people that will actually go out of their way to avoid because they don't know what to say. They don't know what to do. So it's something that is, it is hard, but it's if I don't have any problem with people crying, and you know, I cry a lot myself, so it's not, it's not, you know, I don't feel embarrassed about it because it's completely understandable, and it's, you know, it's only, I suppose, with practice that we've been able to do it where we don't, you know, break down, because if it doesn't happen all the time, sometimes we do, so.
But I feel guilty, like I'm upsetting you, or it's pathetic that I would be the one who cries, or that I'd make, you know. You just, I suppose everyone thinks of their own kids too, and because it's just your worst nightmare. And then you think, good, could I be as good as these people? Could I be as good a person as you guys are?
We're not special. We're not unique.
I think you're very special. I think the idea of sending my baby back into surgery, I just don't know that I could do that. As much as I can sit here now and say, I believe in organ donation and it's brilliant and I can see Megan and I'm so glad she's here. Gee, in that moment, I don't know if I could do that.
I have to say, walking out of that hospital was the hardest thing I have ever had to do.
Leaving him there.
It was very much, I wanted to go back and just, you know, I know the doctors did everything, but it was very much, I wanted to go back and say, you need to do more. I need to take my baby home. And that it wasn't possible is something that I didn't want to, and we both didn't want to become sort of bitter about that. I didn't want, and we didn't want that just because Ethan died, everything should become bad. We've got three other beautiful children that we wanted to show that life is worth living and life, you know, yes, bad things happen, but you can still get up. You can still, you know.
You can still achieve in life. You don't need to become a victim.
Mm.
And one of the big important things that we did, we were fortunate enough that we met the train driver and we were able.
You did, because I read an article in which you said you wanted to.
And we just wanted to cuddle him and tell him that we didn't blame him and it wasn't his fault. He made contact with us and we got that moment, and we're very protective of him. We don't mention who it is or anything for obvious reasons. And he sends us messages on birthdays and anniversaries. And there's not a day that we don't think about that poor man who just simply got up to go to work. And his whole life has been impacted as well. Life is hard and life throws us challenges. But we know firsthand that life's far too short to let those minuscule worries get in your way.
Mm.
You know, Ethan lived, he was loved, he was lost. And unfortunately that's life. We all pass away and death is a taboo subject, particularly children. We don't want to think about that. I've been guilty of turning the radio off when you hear a news story that, you know, a young child has drowned or something like that. But here we are immersed in it, and, you know, we acknowledge that Ethan has passed away. But we celebrate what he's achieved, and you know, it's important for our three other children that we speak about him, and he's still a part of their life in a way, and that's what we do with the foundation and the Jimmy Challenge and everything to you know, allow him to still be a part of our other children's lives. And I'll pass you a poster and some stickers.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, so we partner, our foundation, we don't want to be about us. We partner with Donate Life to help promote the cause and the initiative through the foundation. And on those two stickers, he had two famous sayings, which he didn't use in that context, but they fitted. I actually have them tattooed under my
arms. Oh, you do?
Under
so
my
the question
arms.
Is, am I taking my organs with me? And his answer would have been, no, me not.
Yeah, so...
Do I want to donate my organs? Yeah, me do.
Yeah. And the poster we developed, we didn't want the foundation to be about money. We just wanted it to be about the cause. And we brainstormed some quirky, easy, you know, non-costly ways of promoting it. And the idea of the poster is to take a photo of the poster and upload it to the foundation Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been to the summit of Mount Everest. The soldiers in Afghanistan have held it.
Good idea.
You know, it's been to the White House. It's been all over Australia. We got one just recently from a career firefighter from their air operations unit who's deployed in Canada at the minute assisting with the fires with him over there. And it took off, and it's just a quirky, you know, easy thing that we do.
It is easy, and it's actually a deceptively easy conversation to have, isn't it? It's just a conversation. We're not asking anybody to do anything else but have the conversation. And so then, Megan, I want to be an organ donor, but I don't know if I've done everything that I need to do to be one. What do I need to do so that if something happens to me this afternoon, it's sorted?
Well, there's heaps of ways. So pretty much your next to King's going to have the final say. So
that's the conversation. I have to be very clear with my family and say I want to be an organ donor.
So obviously you've got your license, you've got Medicare, you can go through the Medicare
page,
I believe, and also on Facebook you can do it as a life event. But really at the end of the day, if you've ticked all the boxes and your family doesn't sign off on it, I don't think it will go ahead. So I think the family's the main conversation point.
This is the Nitty Gritty Committee, stories about the guts and the glory of life. Donatelife.gov.au is the official website of organ donation within Australia. It's got lots of information and resources to help you join the conversation that can help save lives. Do you have a partner?
Yeah, I'm married. I got married last year.
You did. So is pregnancy...
It's our next step, hopefully.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So so what do the doctors say about the liver and kidneys?
So as a result of my liver transplant, I actually had an aneurysm in my spleen.
Oh, my God. What is that? Is it a blood clot?
It's like a vein thing going on that could burst. So I had that coiled last year. So I've got an enlarged spleen, so they coiled a bit of that off, which actually is good because now my spleen's shrunk, so it's not sucking up all my blood.
Okay.
So my liver is the best organ in the world. It's just played happy games. My kidney, obviously having one kidney and the creatinine going up and down, you know, I've been on fluid tablets for fluid retention, but that's playing happy now, which is good. So they've pretty much given me the all clear now to have children when we want. So we've just moved into our new house, so get one of those rooms ready.
Yeah.
Hopefully. I don't know. They've just said as far as like fertility and everything, that won't be affected. That's a totally separate issue than your organs. So
yeah,
fingers crossed. My risk of preeclampsia and stuff like that with just one kidney is a little bit higher, but
I had preeclampsia, and I was thinking about it before when you were saying you didn't know you were sick, because I didn't either. And I just went in for my normal checkup on a Friday, and they said, oh, my God, we've got to get the babies out now. I had twins.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel anything. Yeah. I don't know if I'm really bad at keeping tabs on what's going on in my body and taking it seriously and noticing things.
So now I'm really in tune with my body.
Yeah. I think if my eyes went yellow, I might.
Yeah. That was, but back when I was 20, who knows what's going on?
Yes.
But now I can feel a bug coming a mile away. I can feel if my kidneys are off. I can feel if my liver's off.
You must be incredibly attuned to your body. And also, how many surgeries and procedures have you had?
Actually, not that many, to be.
Well, it sounds like you had a lot of coiling and a lot of that.
I've obviously had the two transplants. Yeah. I've had a few scopes, gastroscopes and stuff, but that's nothing here nor there when it comes to surgeries and the coiling, but I was actually awake for that.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's mild sedative.
Then you're so tough now. You're like a footy player, you know? Yeah. You just like don't even care.
That's what I mean. No one treats me different now. Yeah. Like, you're just going in for a day stay. Okay.
Is your life expectancy normal?
I believe so. Wow. They kind of don't really say that. They say I think the longest kidney and liver is like 20, 25 years. So at least give me that. Yeah. But I am really aware of the risk with a pregnancy on my kidney particularly, just with the preeclampsia and that. So that is a risk, and that's why I've still got the fistula, because they may need that during pregnancy to just help it out. But a lot of people have had kidney and liver transplants and gone on to have children and no effects on the transplant. So that's my hope.
Wow. And for you guys, how are you, what sort of parents are you now? Are you helicopter parents? Are you?
Him more so than me.
Yeah. Do you still live on, like,
still
in
live
country?
In the same house.
You still live in the same house?
Yeah, we decided, like, prior to the accident, that was going to be home. That was where we were going to raise our family. It's a little rural community. It's a cracking little place. So I grew up there myself, my parents.
The country kids are pretty nutty, there's a lot of mischief to get into, and there's a lot of dangerous stuff if you...
Well, I was forever getting in trouble being near the dam and all that sort of stuff as a child, you know, but it's a great place. Like, the primary school's got 20 students in the whole school, so, you know, it's an amazing little town, and that's where Ethan's memories are. It's important for the kids, and, you know, at the moment it doesn't feel wrong to live there, but, you know, who's to say in 5, 10, 20 years' time that we go, okay, that's a chapter in our life now that we want to close, but I don't think I could ever sell the house either. I think we'll always have that attachment for obvious reasons, and I've always probably been a more cautious parent given my occupation and, you know, my consequential thinking. And
what's your occupation?
I work for the Department of Justice and Regulation.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
You know, I see what others are capable of doing to other people, and, you know, so I've always been very protective, and my father was a policeman, and I grew up in that type of environment. And it was also important, though, after the accident, that we maintained boundaries with the kids. Like, our eldest Riley, he was 7 at the time, and, you know, it was, I want to sit on the couch. I don't want to go to bed yet. I'm upset about Ethan. No, it's okay to be upset about Ethan, but it's still bedtime. And that tough love was very hard from a parenting point of view. And with other young children, we had to grieve as individuals. We had to grieve as a couple, and we had to help our children.
It's a terrible thing to say, but having 5-year-olds, I can see how they're not malicious, obviously, but how when they know there's something to use.
Correct.
They're not malicious, but they are manipulative.
Oh, that totally. And I had to sort of snigger then. I thought, yeah, of course you would use it too.
I want that lolly because I'm upset about Ethan dying.
Yes.
No, you're not using that as an excuse to get a lolly.
Gosh. And I mean,
go and have an apple.
Again, aren't they amazing? Like, how do you not even get angry at that, get upset at that? Like, you two are just not really... you're not emotional, and I mean that in a good way. You both seem very grounded, down-to-earth, intellectual, do you think?
Geez, intellectual. I don't know that I've ever been referred to as intellectual, but my wife maybe. But look, I think it's – we're parents. We have 4 children, and we always say that we have 4 children. Mm. It's a question that we hate when people say,
"Yes,
how many kids have you got?" But – we have to set an example for our 3 surviving children.
Yeah.
And when they're old enough, when they're adults, if they face challenges in their life, they can look back and go, wow, after everything mum and dad were faced with, look at what they still did. Look at what they still achieved. And they still loved us. They still yelled at us. They still provided everything for us. And where would we be if we didn't give that to our children?
Yeah.
The one thing my silly mother was always right about is one day when you're a parent, you will understand.
Yeah.
And all those times of get away from there, don't do that, she was 100% right. And it's painful being a parent.
Yeah.
It's challenging being a parent. And, you know, to as you'd know, Michelle, obviously being a mum yourself, love is normally a learned emotion. It's something we grow up with. We learn to love the family dog. We learn to love our parents. We learn to love our siblings. And, you know, you in relationships, you fall in love. That's why it's called falling in love. But when you become a parent, to hold that child and to love something so unconditionally, right from the first moment they take their breath, is a very empowering experience. And I can remember saying at Ethan's funeral, I was there for your first breath and I was there for your last breath. Yeah. And I looked at that as a negative. And Michelle's uncle nearly 10 years ago lost his 22-year-old daughter. She passed away quite tragically as well, and she was pregnant and she lost the baby as well. He got stuck in traffic and missed her birth. And she was in Western Australia when she passed away and didn't see her take her last breath. And he said, I would give anything to have what you have. So it comes back to that glass half full, glass half empty. And people look at us and go, wow, can't imagine what you've gone through. But there's people worse off than us. And I have 3 surviving healthy children. I look at the family from Western Australia that lost their 3 children in the plane tragedy in Europe.
The Maslin family, yeah.
And they lost all their babies
instantly.
And we were fortunate enough, we got to give Ethan a cuddle. Mm-hmm. We got to give him a goodbye. And, you know, those families don't get that opportunity. I look at the Morecambes, you know, they would give anything to have had that cuddle as well. So... you know, as I said, we're not special. We're not unique. There's a lot of other people that are stronger and more special than us. We're just ordinary parents trying to do the best we can in, you know, unimaginable circumstances. But it's all for our surviving children and to set an example for them and, you know, to help promote this amazing cause that the Organ and Tissue Authority and the Donate Knife Network have of, you know, having the chat that saves lives, because... who knows, you might need it yourself.
I love the way you always bring it back to that. I love the way you guys always, all 3 of you, bring it back to that. Would you accept one? It's that simple. And then where do you expect it's coming from if you're not prepared to donate one?
And can I just say, from all the recipients, we thank the donor families. It's really important.
Yeah, we know that. We've been fortunate. We've met many recipients, and you know it must be such an emotional struggle. But don't ever feel guilty, because the donor families do it because they want to. We did it because we wanted to. We didn't do it because we had to, and we weren't pressured in any way to have to do it. And to me, to all the recipients that we've met, it is just so humbling to see how you get on with life, because our Jimmy was full of life, and to know that he's kept someone to have their life is just, it's amazing.
Mm. Yeah. But also you guys still talking about it after the event, like Megan, for you to come here and, you know, and know that you're going to be with John and Michelle, and we're going to be talking about them losing their child so that someone else could have a donation like you. I mean, you don't have to do that. You could have got your kidney and liver and just got on with your life, you know. It's very brave of you, very generous of you to do that. So thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Oh, thanks, guys. I'm so sorry. I've cried so much at you all today. Oh, thank you. Michelle and John have created the Ethan Jimmy Seckel Foundation to raise awareness around organ and tissue donation. They have a Facebook page where you can show your support and ask for posters and bumper stickers. There are links on my website, michellelaurie.com. On behalf of all of us here at Nitty Gritty HQ, which is actually just me and Kieran Simpson, thank you for downloading this podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a like. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a nice review on iTunes. If you didn't, just tweet Kieran. Bye-bye.